January 1996, Christie's offices, London. Christie's chairman, Sir Anthony Tennant, and CEO Christopher Davidge are meeting in Tennant's office. Despite working together on a plot to fix prices over the last couple of years, the two have never been what you'd call friends. And today, Davidge is furious. He leans in, his mouth drawn in a thin, angry line. My year-end bonus was pitiful, and then on top of that, you gave me a poor performance review. You didn't even have the decency to talk to me about it. After everything I did for you last year, Tennant holds firm. I know you feel you did a great deal of work, but the fact is, I'm still not happy. I have one long-term goal for this company, and that's surpassing Sotheby's. And that's where you have failed. Look, our costs are rising more than Sotheby's, and yet Dee Dee Brooks got a bonus that's twice as much as mine. Ms. Brooks lives in New York City. It's apples and oranges. But what about how I increased our commission? You can't say that's not a significant accomplishment. An accomplishment you and I achieved together. Davidge is growing angrier and angrier. Are you willing to recalculate my bonus or not? Tennant pulls out a calculator. If we take 0.3% of our pre-tax profits, that will give you a bonus of $111,000. Will that be satisfactory? It's still less than Brooks. Christopher, you are a great asset to Christie's, and your continued loyalty is vital to the success of this company. Well, maybe you should start treating me like it. While Davidge grows bitter he's not getting enough recognition for his role in the price-fixing scheme, across the pond in New York, Dee Dee Brooks is thriving. She's the first ever female CEO of an auction house, but she wants to raise her profile even more by becoming an auctioneer. As Davidge watches his counterpart soar, he fixates on the pages upon pages of meticulous notes he took on his illegal meetings with Dee Dee Brooks. The U.S. feds are building a case against Sotheby's and Christie's. And these notes could be a shield or a weapon.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's vice chair and president, Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though many of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill talk about how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can check out this episode and a whole lot more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts. From Wondery, I'm David Brown, and this is Business Wars. In our last episode, the CEOs of Christie's and Sotheby's held a series of secret meetings, conspiring to change their fees in tandem, raising profits for both companies. By the end of 1995, sales were up. The plot was looking like a great success for both auction houses. But it couldn't last. Soon, The price-fixing conspiracy will come to a head when both the authorities and the public learn of the illegal practices involved. All four will pay, but in different ways. This is Episode 3, The Unraveling. April 25th, 1996, an auction hall in New York City. It's a once-in-a-lifetime auction for Sotheby's, selling items from the estate of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. It's also the auction that will take Dee Dee Brooks from successful CEO to media darling. Backstage, Brooks approaches Lisa Hubbard, a seasoned auctioneer and the head of the Sotheby's jewelry department in Hong Kong. Hubbard, along with several other top auctioneers at the company, has flown in at Brooks' request. Hubbard is a single mother, and she's brought her young daughter along to watch her auction off the former First Lady's costume jewelry collection. Hubbard scans the catalog one more time, her daughter at her side. Hubbard's about to walk on stage when Brooks interrupts.
There's been a last-minute change in plans. I'm going to be taking these lots.
Hubbard is flummoxed.
Excuse me? We flew all the way from Hong Kong for this.
Hubbard puts an arm around her daughter. She can't believe Brooks is serious.
I'll hand the reins over to you for some of the later lots.
Before Hubbard can protest, Brooks strides onto the stage, beaming for the audience and the cameras.
Good evening. Our first item up for auction tonight is this triple strand of fake pearls, famously seen in the 1962 photo of Jackie Kennedy with her young son. Do I hear 500?
In the end, Brooks auctions off more than 100 lots herself before turning things over to Hubbard. By then, all of the most exciting items have already sold. The auction brings in $2.5 million and sets a world record for exceeding its pre-auction estimate of $39,000. A jubilant Brooks tells everyone who will listen that it was the most extraordinary experience of her career. Her staff isn't as thrilled. The weeks leading up to the Kennedy sale brought out an even more brutal side of the CEO, who berated employees and made unrealistic demands. Soon, she'll be taking fire from outside Sotheby's, too. In June 1996, Brooks receives an alarming letter from the UK's Office of Fair Trading, informing her that inquiries are being made into possible anti-competitive practices. Davidge receives the same letter. Both deny any wrongdoing, assuring their company's counsel there was no collusion and refusing to further engage. They're hoping to distance themselves from the investigation as much as possible. Brooks hopes it will just go away, but she won't be able to ignore the issue forever. January 1997. At Sotheby's New York, Dee Dee Brooks and Alfred Taubman are meeting to discuss an estate they're desperate to win. Brooks passes Taubman a binder with images of the collection.
It's a very high-end assortment of Impressionist pieces from the estate of diplomat John Langolith Lowe. There's a Manet, a Toulouse-Lautrec, and other high-value works.
Hey, it looks extraordinary. So what did you need to talk to me about?
The client is demanding we drop the vendor's commission.
Taubman raises an eyebrow.
You said the estimate came in at $90 million, so we would be sacrificing almost $2 million.
Correct. But the buyer's premium will give us far more than that.
Waiving the commission here would go against our deal with Christie's.
The market is back. It's every man for himself. Plus, they've broken the rules before, too. Remember the Salima Aga Khan collection?
Then I guess we have to do it.
Davidge is dismayed when he learns Brooks has violated their deal to win the collection. Christie's begrudgingly offers to match Sotheby's, and some of Davidge's colleagues suggest they sweeten the deal by throwing in a charitable contribution to the Loeb Family Foundation. But Davidge decides he can't authorize that. One of the earliest agreements he made with Brooks was that the two auction houses would no longer use donations as a bargaining tactic. If he doesn't honor that, the whole deal starts to fall apart. In the end, Christie's is still able to win the Loeb auction due to a personal family connection of Stephen Lash, the head of Christie's Trusts and Estates Department. And while Lash is happy to be called upon for the favor, he's been growing suspicious of potential collusion. He's starting to ask questions that no one wants to answer. Years of risky and illegal behavior are finally catching up to Sotheby's and Christie's, and the cracks in their plan are beginning to show. February 1997. Christopher Davidge, a glass of champagne in hand, addresses employees at Christie's London, a smug smile on his face. At this moment, all of the secrecy and anxiety feels worth it. He clinks his glass.
Annual sales are in, and I'm thrilled to announce that we have surpassed Sotheby's for the first time since 1954. We brought in $1.6 billion, Sotheby's $1.59 billion. I know a difference of only $21 million may seem negligible, but our sales are also up 9%, Sotheby's down 5%. The tides are changing in this business. Soon, Christie's will undeniably be the top auction house in the world.
But as Christie's celebrates, the U.S. Department of Justice is beginning to put together a case. In May of 1997, both companies received subpoenas. The Justice Department received a tip from an anonymous source who told them to look into the non-negotiable commission rates. The source was convinced they were the result of illegal backroom deals between Sotheby's and Christie's. The subpoena calls for documents dating back 5 years, including all records of communication between the two auction houses. The night the subpoenas are received, Brooks calls Davidge at his London home. She's feeling panicked.
Hello?
It's me.
I take it you've also had a lot of fun legal meetings today.
My lawyers asked about you, the nature of our communication. I told them we've just met several times to discuss ordinary industry things, auction scheduling and joint agreements, but we should go over our calendars and make sure we have our story straight about the dates we met.
Davidge looks at a pile of papers on his table. His meticulous notes, taken after each meeting with Brooks, unbeknownst to her. He decides to lie.
I haven't kept any calendar record of our meetings. There's no story to get straight.
Really? No paper trail at all?
Nothing. I do feel, however, it would be foolish for us to continue speaking at all after this conversation, at least as long as this investigation is underway.
Of course. But I want you to rest assured, I've told no one about our conversations.
Likewise.
While Brooks has never been sure how much she can actually trust Davidge, there is one thing she believes, that he'll stay quiet because he would have just as much to lose as her if the truth came out. What she doesn't know is that Davidge is unhappy, tired of disagreements with Tennant and his colleagues, and contemplating early retirement. He no longer has as much to lose as Brooks, who has aspirations of many more years in the industry. The Fed's case progresses slowly, dragging on with little public attention. 1999 is an exceptional year for Sotheby's and Brooks. They sell the private art collection of Mr. and Mrs. John Hay Whitney, one of the most renowned in the country, for over $128 million. They also break records with sales of a Picasso portrait and Lou Gehrig's last baseball glove. Sotheby's sales are up almost $1 billion from where they were just 5 years earlier, and Christie's moment on top has proved to be short-lived. But as the new millennium dawns, a fruitful partnership turns sour, as one side decides to save itself.
You know, Audible has a brand new collection of exclusive thrillers. Every move is made more exciting by captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. I just downloaded The Grand Opening by Carl Weber. It's a mystery about a family business in a small southern town, and there are secrets around every turn. You know, when I'm listening, the time just disappears, getting completely immersed in the story and the performances. And as an Audible member, you get to keep one title a month from their entire catalog, including bestsellers and new releases. So come on, listen along. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Head on over to audible.com/BW or just text BW to 500-500. That's audible.com/BW or text BW to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
January 27th, 2000, a luxury resort in the Dominican Republic. Dee Dee Brooks is sipping a cocktail on the balcony of her suite as the sun sets. She's tired after a long round of golf with some of Sotheby's top clients. Puzzled as to who would be calling, she grabs the phone.
Hello?
Hi, Dee Dee. It's Don.
Don Pillsbury is one of Sotheby's lawyers.
What's going on?
I'm afraid it's not good news. We received a call from Christie's today. They asked to break off the joint defense agreement we made back when the subpoenas were issued in 1997.
A joint defense agreement meant Sotheby's and Christie's had previously agreed to allow their respective attorneys to have conversations that fall under the umbrella of attorney-client privilege. It's common practice when multiple defendants share a common interest. Brooks is stunned.
Christopher Dovich left Christie's a month ago. It was quite abrupt.
Do you have any idea why he left?
I haven't spoken to the man in years. I have no idea.
Brooks is reeling. Was Dovich forced out because he was discovered? Did he rat her out?
Don, I think I need to hire a criminal attorney.
There's a pause as Pillsbury takes this in.
I can make some calls on your behalf. We can try to get you a meeting as early as tomorrow.
I fly back in the morning.
Brooks sinks onto the bed, terrified. The next day, Brooks is back at Sotheby's, New York, but she hasn't slept a wink since the call from Pillsbury. As she waits for her new lawyer to arrive, Diana Phillips from the Sotheby's press department appears at her office door.
I have a meeting starting in just a moment. It's urgent.
Phillips walks in and sits down.
We just received a call from a reporter with the Financial Times. They want a comment for an article they're running tomorrow. Christie's has turned over new information to the Justice Department. They've been granted conditional amnesty from prosecution.
Brooks struggles to remain calm in front of her colleague, but her stomach drops as she takes in this news.
They're asking for Sotheby's response. No comment.
Just then, John Siffert, a boyish-looking 52-year-old, appears outside the windows of Brooks's office, holding a briefcase. Brooks has asked him to represent her as her criminal lawyer.
Please show Mr. Siffert in on your way out.
Phillips leaves and Siffert enters, smiling politely at Brooks.
Thank you for coming. Let's go to the conference room next door.
I assume Sotheby's counsel will be joining us?
Brooks doesn't respond, ushering him to an empty conference room next to her office. Siffert watches in confusion as Dee Dee Brooks breaks down in tears.
What I have to tell you, I haven't told anyone, not even my husband.
Brooks proceeds to tell Siffert through tears
about her years of conversations with Christopher Dobbage.
I knew I could have and should have stopped it. I could have said no, and I didn't. I tried to tell myself I wasn't doing anything illegal, that we were only talking.
Well, did you and Dobbage make agreements?
I mean, I never signed anything. I never used those words, I agree to it. The seller's commission, we talked about it for maybe an hour, at most two. I just wanted him to do it, and we would follow.
Ms. Brooks, unfortunately, what you're describing does constitute an agreement. Are you familiar with the Sherman Antitrust Act?
Only in name.
It's a law that prohibits any activities that restrict competition in the marketplace.
And what are the consequences?
Well, a violation of this nature can carry a sentence of up to 3 years in federal prison, as well as extensive fines for both corporations and individuals.
3 years. What should I do now?
We'll have to meet with Sotheby's lawyers, but I don't think you should say anything yet. You should focus on telling your family and thinking about what you'd like to do. If you tell Sotheby's or the Justice Department what you just told me, there's no turning back. But you'll need to think about whether you'd like to cooperate with the investigation.
You mean come clean?
Yes.
Will you represent me?
I'm not sure if I can. I already represent multiple Sotheby's clients. It's a conflict of interest. It's possible if I get permission. If not, I promise to help you find another lawyer. But either way, for now, look, my professional advice is you say as little as possible.
After an emotional 90-minute meeting, Brooks and Siffert meet with Sotheby's attorneys and executives. Everyone is shocked as Brooks warns them about a potentially earth-shattering story that will break in the media the next day. After her warning, the usually unflappable Brooks sits in near silence. The following morning, the headline on the front page of the Financial Times reads, "Christie's admits fixing commissions. Auction house tells the U.S. Justice Department that it may deal with Sotheby's." Accompanying the story is a photo of Dee Dee Brooks. On January 30, 2000, an antitrust civil lawsuit is filed against Christie's and Sotheby's in New York by Chris Lovell, a prominent lawyer. In the following days, over a dozen more disgruntled auction house customers file their own lawsuits. Sotheby's stock plummets nearly 15%. As a private company, Christie's doesn't have to worry about stock prices and short-term revenue. They swiftly announce new changes to their pricing, making it more expensive to buy and cheaper to sell, effectively making themselves more appealing than Sotheby's for prospective sellers. A few weeks later, in February 2000, Dee Dee Brooks sits in a Paris hotel room. She's there to attempt to snare a Picasso estimated at $30 million. Even with everything going on, she's never stopped doing her job, sticking to her same busy schedule as usual, while awaiting further news about the upcoming legal proceedings with trepidation. She wearily answers the phone to find Don Pillsbury from Sotheby's legal team on the other end.
What is it now?
We met with the audit committee of the Sotheby's board today and told them your account of the conspiracy with Christie's.
And?
I'm very sorry to be the one to tell you this, but there are a lot of concerns about your future with the company.
Brooks's face falls. The news doesn't come as a surprise, but it's still a crushing blow.
You may want to return to New York as soon as possible.
Tomorrow I am pitching for the Picasso. It's why I'm here, and I plan to see it through.
Look, I'm not about to tell you what to do. But later this week, we have a meeting to prepare for facing the federal prosecutors.
How do you think that will go?
If Sotheby's is to enter a corporate guilty plea, it could spare you and Alfred Taubman from being prosecuted as individuals.
But we don't know that they'll agree to that.
No, we don't.
You know what's ironic? all of this is about ensuring healthy competition. If this lawsuit puts Sotheby's out of business, Christie's may as well have a monopoly.
We are determined not to let that happen.
On February 14th, Sotheby's lawyers are horrified when Brooks's personal lawyers lay out her story, revealing Brooks has been lying to them since the start of the conspiracy. They tentatively discuss a potential joint defense agreement between Brooks, Taubman, and Sotheby's, with hopes of reaching a settlement that could limit the punishment to a corporate fine. On February 21st, 2000, Brooks and Taubman are forced to resign from Sotheby's. Through it all, Taubman continues to loudly proclaim his innocence to anyone who will listen, insisting he was completely in the dark and had no knowledge of the collusion. 3 days after they both resign, Brooks sends him a handwritten letter.
Dear Alfred, I hardly know what to say. You have been so much on my mind that I just wanted to write and tell you that no matter what happens, I will always have incredible memories of our years together. You have played an extraordinarily important role in my life, and hopefully one day in the future we will be able to look back and share some of the amazing things we did together. Take care of yourself. With much love, Dee Dee.
Meanwhile, Brooks and her lawyer, John Siffert, start prepping for the hearings. And Siffert has a controversial proposal. He wants to test out her willingness to throw her former mentor under the bus to save her own skin.
If you went directly to the Department of Justice and tried to strike a deal, you might be able to avoid jail time.
You mean go behind everyone's back?
Yes. If you take this option, you can't tell Alfred Taubman or Sotheby's counsel.
No. I don't want to unnecessarily hurt them. Taubman has been decent to me throughout my career, and I still feel a sense of responsibility toward Sotheby's and its employees. I want them to take responsibility with me. If I go over their heads, I'm taking an opportunity away from them.
Well, as long as you understand the risks.
By the end of February, rumors begin to circulate that the government is in possession of documents Dobbage turned over. Christie's has been cooperating with the authorities, and in doing so, they stand to lose much less than Sotheby's. In September 2000, the class action civil suit is settled, with each auction house required to pay out $256 million to the plaintiffs. But the upcoming legal proceedings for Taubman and Brooks will bring unwanted surprises. As business owners and managers, you use software for your business every day. You use one piece of software to manage your customers, another to manage your employees, another to manage your finances, and the list goes on. You buy these pieces independently and hope they fit neatly together like a puzzle. And then you find out the hard way that they don't, and you end up with a mess at the heart of your business operations. Does any of this sound familiar? Well, fortunately, Zoho offers a solution to this chaos. It's called Zoho One. Zoho One is a suite of around 50 pre-integrated business applications that fit together beautifully. So instead of dealing with disparate software from multiple vendors with multiple contracts and price points, you deal with one vendor with all the pieces of the business software puzzle neatly put together, offered at a very attractive price. Now, if this sounds interesting to you, you got to check out Zoho One at zoho.one. That's Zoho.one. With Zoho, you're not just licensing apps. You're licensing peace of mind. We get support from Airbnb. Staying in an Airbnb is often one of my favorite parts of a trip, especially on business travel. Instead of slogging to another hotel and waiting in line after you've been driving or flying all day, there is nothing better than landing in a place that, well, really feels like a home away from home. Maybe you've stayed in an Airbnb before and thought to yourself, you know, this actually seems pretty doable. Maybe my place could be an Airbnb. Well, I'm here to tell you it could be. You could be sitting on an Airbnb and not even know it. It might be as simple as starting with your spare room, or maybe even your whole place when you're away. Say you and your family are headed away for a much-deserved spring break.
well, why not Airbnb your place and make some extra money towards the trip? Win-win. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
October 5th, 2000. Dee Dee Brooks stands before Judge Richard M. Berman in a federal courtroom. Her lawyer, John Siffert, stands beside her. Brooks reads from a prepared statement.
At the direction of a superior at Sotheby's Holdings, I had a number of meetings and conversations with a representative of Christie's International, during which, among other things, we agreed to fix prices with respect to commissions charged to sellers.
Mrs. Brooks, what's your plea?
Guilty.
By pleading guilty, Brooks has forced her former employer's hand. In the same court session, Don Pillsbury pleads guilty on behalf of Sotheby's, which comes with a $45 million fine. But the judge won't let it end there. Before agreeing to the $45 million, he wants to see how the civil suit resolves, and if it's determined the 130,000 clients involved in the class action are sufficiently compensated. When all is said and done, it's possible Sotheby's may owe even more. As for Christopher Dovidge, by cooperating with prosecutors, he has secured himself immunity. In December 2000, he marries Amrita Javeri, an Indian socialite 25 years his junior, in an ostentatious four-day celebration. He met Javeri when she consulted with Christie's as an expert on Indian artwork. Strangely, his role in the conspiracy only elevates his social status. He does not, however, get his wish for early retirement and is instead forced to resign. But because he turned over his notes and gained amnesty for Christie's in the process, his lawyers were able to negotiate an impressive severance package. On May 2, 2001, the Justice Department indicts both Sotheby's Alfred Taubman and Christie's Anthony Tennant. Taubman pleads not guilty. Tennant is safe as long as he remains in Britain, where price-fixing is neither a criminal or extraditable crime. But he, too, maintains his innocence publicly. Soon, Taubman will stand trial, his entire case hinging on the prosecution's star witness, Dee Dee Brooks. November 8th, 2001. Downtown Manhattan is still reeling from the tragic September 11th attacks, which postponed these proceedings for a month. As guards stand outside the court at the Thurgood Marshall United States Federal Courthouse, Alfred Taubman, now 76 years old, exits a black Range Rover wearing a gray three-piece suit with a dark blue tie. Along with his lawyers, he walks up the steps and into a large auditorium. Due to the media attention surrounding the case, it was relocated at the last minute to accommodate more spectators. Taubman's attorney, Bob Fisk, addresses the jurors.
Dee Dee Brooks, CEO of Sotheby's, is a person who has no notes, who has repeatedly lied, and is testifying against Mr. Taubman in this case because he is her get-out-of-jail-free card. You'll find her testimony is not going to be enough to convict my client and send him to prison.
In addition to Brooks's testimony, Taubman has something else working against him. Records supporting the fact that he did hold meetings with Sir Anthony Tennant, although he denies the contents of those meetings were anything illegal. Dovidge also takes the stand, where he testifies that the entire conspiracy was Taubman's idea. This is an important point, as Christie's immunity is dependent on the belief that Sotheby's initiated the wrongdoing. Although in private, Dovidge suggests to friends that he actually suspected Tennant had been the one to manufacture the scheme. On Monday, November 19th, Brooks and Dovidge briefly cross paths in the government witness room.
Good luck on the stand.
Thank you. Congratulations on your evidence.
As Brooks testifies, Taubman is often seen shaking his head in despair.
When the Financial Times article came out with my picture on the front page, Mr. Taubman held it up for me and said, "You look good in stripes." Just before we met with our lawyers, he told me, "You know, just don't act like a girl." I think he was just telling me to be tough.
Dismayed, Taubman leans into his lawyer.
"She's quite an actress. Amazing, really. She's trying to set this whole thing up like I was a boss beating her up for being female."
After 16 days of testimony, Taubman is found guilty. The verdict shocks the art world and Sotheby's employees, who are terrified of how it may affect business. Christie's, meanwhile, is able to remain relatively unscathed. Sotheby's cuts costs to reduce its losses and raises its buyer's premium to increase revenue. On April 22, 2002, Taubman is sentenced to 1 year in jail and a fine of $7.5 million, 5% of the estimated $150 million in profits affected by the price fixing. The judge does not hold back in his statement.
"One cannot give to the poor and steal from the rich. Price fixing is a crime, whether it's committed in the local grocery store or the halls of great auction houses. This was a deceitful, secretive criminal scheme whose object and purpose was illegal profit. It was not motivated by desperation or by need, but by arrogance and greed."
The judge also calls Taubman out for maintaining his innocence, taking no responsibility and showing no remorse. Next, it is Dee Dee Brooks's turn to be sentenced. A few weeks earlier, she was forced to repay $3.25 million to Sotheby's, representing her net pay since 1993, when the conspiracy began. She was also forced to pay all of her own legal fees and forfeit all stock options. Meanwhile, in London, Christopher Dobbage managed to gain nearly $13 million from his severance, pension, and consulting work. On April 29, 2002, Brooks enters the courtroom wearing an olive green suit, surrounded by her family and friends. To begin the proceedings, her attorney, John Siffert, asks the judge to consider a lenient sentence.
"Mrs. Brooks will always bear the stigma of being a convicted felon, which will have collateral consequences for the rest of her life. She now owns only what she earned before the conspiracy and what her husband gifted to her in their 30 years of marriage. To make her serve time in jail now, I submit, would be cruel and unnecessary, considering what she suffered."
By the time the judge speaks, everyone in the courtroom is on the edge of their seats.
"Diana Brooks, by your own actions, you have traded your title of CEO to be branded a thief and a common criminal. Blinded by ambition, you substituted shame for fame. You allowed yourself to go from respected, successful executive to being ridiculed as a caricature for a melodrama. The notoriety you have gained will outlive you. The debt you owe to society may never be fully repaid. Would you like to speak?"
Brooks nods, standing.
"I would like to apologize to all the people I've hurt. I will forever bear the burden for what I've done, and I will accept whatever sentence your honor feels is appropriate."
"I hereby sentence you to 3 years probation, including 6 months of house arrest, plus 1,000 hours of community service and a criminal fine of $350,000.
The reaction from Brooks and her family is mixed. Siffert leans over to his client.
"No jail time. That's wonderful news."
But something else is troubling Brooks.
"The judge said I will always be known for this, that I can never make up for it. That's not right, is it?"
"He's only a judge."
Perhaps the most shocking thing about the entire conspiracy is that profits at Sotheby's and Christie's are hardly affected. People still want to sell their art. and there simply aren't many other options. Despite the undeniable blemish on the industry's reputation, the business remains. Recent years have opened up the art market in new ways. Online auctions are able to reach a new, international, younger kind of buyer. NFTs are sold for millions, and items are paid for with cryptocurrency. But one thing hasn't changed. Sotheby's and Christie's are still in neck-and-neck competition, dominating the auction house business. In 2021, Sotheby's made $7.3 billion to Christie's $7.1 billion. Despite modest beginnings and a price-fixing scandal that will forever be associated with both company names, the auction business has proven resilient. In many ways, their impenetrable industry duopoly has been the very thing to ensure their success. Honesty matters less when dishonesty is the only game in town. From Wondery, this is Episode 3 of Sotheby's vs. Christie's for Business Wars. A quick note about recreations that you've been hearing. In most cases, we can't know exactly what was said. Those scenes are dramatizations, but they're based on historical research. If you'd like to read more about Sotheby's and Christie's price-fixing scandal, we recommend The Art of the Steal by Christopher Mason. I'm your host, David Brown. Aaron Conley wrote this story. Voice acting by Michelle Phillippe. Karen Lowe is our senior producer and editor. Edited and produced by Emily Frost. Sound design by Kyle Randall. Our producer is Dave Schilling. Fact-checking by Will Tavlin. Our managing producers are Tanja Thigpen and Matt Gant. Our executive producers are Jenny Lauer-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Created by Hernan Lopez. For Wondery.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.